Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast titled Accelerate Your Next Embedded Development Project. I'm Kurt Schwader, Technical Editor at Open Systems Media, and today's moderator with speakers Mark Brown from Wind River and Chris Rommel from VDC Research. Today's total briefing is scheduled for about 50 minutes, leaving a 10-minute Q&A at the end. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your audience console. First is the Enlarge Slides button. This button will maximize the slides to fill your entire screen. The Download Slides button will allow you to download and print the slides if you'd like a hard copy to follow along with. The button labeled Forward to a Friend enables you to send an email to someone that will include a registration link so they can also attend. The Ask a Question text box and associated Submit Your Question buttons allow you to participate in today's eCast. You simply type your question into the text box and submit it by clicking on the button. You can submit these questions at any time, and we encourage you to do so early and often while the question is fresh in your mind. We'll do our best to address them during the closing Q&A. If you have any questions with respect to the eCast operation itself, you can submit those too, and our technicians will respond to you during the eCast. Finally, this eCast will be posted online within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available. We'll talk about this more at the end. Multicore processors are here in force and commonly used in embedded applications. Operating system software, hypervisors, and virtualization of these multicore platforms provide a foundation for the latest, greatest embedded products, but also require special skills, experience, and tools in order to drive embedded projects to a successful end. Today, we're pleased to have with us experts in the embedded development who will be sharing market information and new development paradigms that enable successful embedded development with the latest hardware and software technologies. Today's presenters are Mark Brown, Vice President of Tools and Marketing Operations in the Products Group at Wind River, and Chris Rommel, Vice President, Embedded Software and Tools at VDC Research. Mark is responsible for Wind River's overall tools, product strategy, business planning, and program execution. Product group marketing operations, including product marketing, financial and business operations, and GTM. In addition, Mark is responsible for strategic corporate initiatives for security and development lifecycle, working closely with the Wind River CTO office, corporate marketing, and the products team on strategy, product planning, and partner ecosystem. Chris Rommel is responsible for syndicated research and consulting engagements focused on embedded software, hardware, and development solutions. He has worked with a wide variety of clients, supporting a range of projects, including competitive analyses, strategic marketing initiative support, ecosystem development strategies, and vertical market opportunity assessments. Chris's prior research also includes studies on multi-core components and tools, operating systems, software development tools, and software system lifecycle management tools. Mark will kick off the presentations today. Mark, the floor is yours.
Thanks very much. So today what we'd like to cover, both myself and Chris, is to talk to you guys about some of the challenges that software development teams are experiencing while developing next-generation embedded devices. I'm going to start off and I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the industry challenges and some of the changes and trends that are having a very large and significant impact on organizations in multiple dimensions. I'm going to turn it over to Chris. Chris is then going to go through and talk about a number of the data and trends that VDC has been following around embedded development, and then turn it back to me so I can walk through some of the new ways that Wind River is suggesting organizations adopt and really look at to help them accelerate development while maintaining quality, improving security, and meeting your time-to-market needs. Now, the first thing I want to talk about are some of the significant industry challenges that our customers are dealing with. And, you know, I think it's a very exciting time for all of us that really deal on a day-to-day basis with the embedded market. I think given a lot of the new technology trends of multi-core and global connectivity, it's adding new capabilities and performance levels that none of us probably ever expected, and we're becoming more and more reliant on embedded devices that manage our public utilities, keep us connected for work and with loved ones and so on. I think the negative side or the downside, however, are really the impact that some of these drivers are having on organizations. If we just look at global connectivity, There's a very, very large increase in needs around security and safety, as well as quality requirements that are now coming into systems. Because as more and more systems are interconnected, there's more opportunities for people to hack into a device that needs to have the security, or potentially impact a device that could cause a safety issue. A lot of these are being driven because of a lot of market drivers. We see machine-to-machine as a new paradigm that people are looking at within businesses to actually reduce overall operational expenses, to provide better real-time telemetry and analytics, and really look at almost proactive diagnostics of devices before they fail and actually bring down infrastructure. We're also seeing an ever-increasing need for performance and scalability. Every day, more people want to do more on the internet and across the network infrastructures. This is actually driving the adoption of multi-core, many-core, and system-on-chip architectures that are needed to continue to actually scale and drive performance expectations. And then lastly, there's a significant business push to lower operational expenses as well as capital expenditures. And in doing so, it's driving the adoption of system consolidation designs, where in the past, a system could be made up of a number of discrete boards within a rack, but today they're being shrunk down to one multi-core processor that you've got each of those board components now running on an individual core within the multi-core part. Now, this is great for lowering power consumption. It's great for lowering your overall hardware costs. But the flip side of all of these things is what they're really driving around the cost of innovation. So by gaining performance, by reducing costs, by having global connectivity, what we're seeing is a huge amount of risk, project risk, getting projects out to market that are going to deliver the expected performance, getting those products out to market with the right quality and security needs, and actually meeting your time to market areas. And these are all side effects of this very, very significant increase in complexity that's being driven by all of these competing factors. Now, this is just some of the areas that our customers are dealing with. Chris is going to get in and talk about some of the specific market trends that VDC is following and certainly providing guidance to customers. And then I'm going to drive in and talk a little bit about some of the lifecycle activities you can do to minimize project risk, make sure that your teams are still delivering at your time-to-market windows with the desired quality, security, performance, and so on, and really help you guys accelerate your development efforts going forward. So with that, Chris, I'll turn the floor over to you and let you go through some of the exciting data and trends that you guys have got captured.
Great. Thanks, Mark. So before I dive into my discussion about some of the leading trends we've been following, I want to take just a quick minute to ensure everyone is familiar with VDC and who we are and what we do, put some context around some of our research. So we're a market research and consulting company, founded originally in 1971, and we track any number of different technology markets, with the embedded software and tools market being one of the prime points of focus for the company. And so as part of that research program, each year we reach out to the embedded engineering community. We ask them any number of questions about their current projects, their preferences, and their expectations for the future. And so this first slide highlights some of the findings from our 2011 Embedded System Engineering Survey that we conducted earlier this year. And if you have been following VDC's research for a number of years, and this is probably one of the statistics that you've heard us talk about before, being schedule adherence. And one of the reasons why we seem to come back to this year after year is that it's a statistic that really hasn't improved. And as an example, if you look back at our 2009 survey results, which were collected in the beginning part of 2009 during the depth of the recession, when you figure a lot of organizations had significantly cut back on their resources, our results this year are really only marginally better, with 37% of engineers this year reporting late projects compared to 40% of the people we surveyed 2 years ago. So what's really the problem here is something that we keep coming back to and trying to evaluate. And just from looking at it, obviously, it's not just a single problem. There are a lot of different issues and factors that can drive schedule delay. I mean, that said, there are a couple of common themes that really seem to emerge at the top of the list time and time again when we reach out to the engineers. We ask them, you know, what are some of the things leading to the delay of their project? You know, it's things like changes in specifications, the complexity application, as Mark talked about before, just the fact that often customers are changing requirements more frequently. And then given a lot of the technological changes and evolution of a lot of these components, just the technical obstacles associated with trying to meet some of these project goals. And so, again, kind of summing up that list, what you can see from those factors is that the growing complexity and just the rate of change in project requirements is the main underlying issue for delay. So this can mean a few things. That, you know, one, OEMs just don't understand the project well enough to ahead of time to plan and allocate resources and set reasonable schedules from the start. And that, two, OEMs largely perhaps don't have the processes and or tools in place to help them effectively meet their project's requirements. And although, you know, obviously both of these are very important, I and VDC really believe that the second reason is becoming an increasingly critical point for consideration going forward. So clearly a large percentage of projects are still on or ahead of schedule. It's every project in the industry isn't late. But I do think that it's a fair assessment to say that the status quo just isn't working for enough of the embedded engineering community. And as the volume and sophistication of software specifically that's being required by devices going forward, as that continues to grow, you know, OEMs need to be willing to change. And so on this next slide, I wanted to dive a little bit deeper into what some of the common development processes and workflows look like in the embedded market. And in the picture at the top of the slide, you know, I'm showing the VDC's general taxonomy for the different phases as we, you know, as we look to break down the development cycle. And clearly, this in some ways, you know, an oversimplification of a very complex process. And I'm sure that it's likely very different from the ways many of you would break down the SDLC. But nevertheless, I think it should still serve as a good point for illustrating at least a typical project workflow at a high level. And traditionally, when you look at a more granular view of an embedded project workflow, you'd also see a number of very specific engineering tasks broken out by different components of the end device, whether that be firmware or application software, algorithm design, et cetera. And these various engineering tasks also had engineers whose roles generally revolved almost exclusively around that particular task. And certainly at a high level, you can understand how the coordination of this array of different engineering disciplines and tasks adds a layer of complexity to project management and execution that, you know, you probably wouldn't see in development of software for enterprise IT systems or just pure ISVs. Now, however, engineers are being forced to look and conduct a significant amount of work outside of that original primary role, where now you have things where people that are IC SoC engineers are can be conducting firmware development and application engineers involved is in system architecture design, as an example. So what does this mean? We believe that that it is and will continue to become increasingly important for OEMs to look toward new methodologies and new solution sets that can let them more efficiently accelerate, execute, and manage all of these various tasks across the development cycle. So as I mentioned before, the evolution of embedded device requirements and the functionality expectations that customers hold has continued to pressure embedded engineering organizations to add more and more software content to their devices. And as you would anticipate, one of the first places we can look to for evidence of this trend is within the average number of lines of code that engineers report within their current projects. And our research showed that nearly half of all engineers expect that their total software code base is to grow on their next project. And beyond that, the overall expected change in terms of growth clocks in an annualized rate of over 40%. That means if you were to take the average lines of code on the left side of the slide here and apply that annualized rate, you could be looking at an average embedded project having over 1 million lines of code within the next year. And, you know, clearly there can be a lot of variability in these figures from industry to industry. You know, with projects in the mobile phone sector, for example, you know, often showing average amounts of in-house code that are about five times the size reported for industrial automation projects. Just as one example. But one, I guess, additional important qualification when you look at these figures is that they are for an engineer's personal project or the project they're primarily working on, which doesn't necessarily even represent the aggregate lines of code for the entire end device. So if you consider the final system or device lines of code, you could be looking at figures much or even magnitudes larger than those reported here on the slide. And so on the table to the left of the slide, you also notice that we've just tracked not the internally developed code used within engineers' projects, but also the code they're using from other sources. And whether it's IP or stack components they have licensed commercially, or even times when they go out to sources that are open source to get different software assets. And over recent years, we've continued to see that engineering organizations look to these types of third-party sources in greater frequency. And that's largely the means to combat, you know, what's really ubiquitous time-to-market challenges and pressures. But this is another area, however, where there's often a great deal of variability between different industries. I mean, just as an example, I'm sure, you know, many of you listening who might potentially work on a military aerospace project, I'm sure you would anticipate that, you know, that industry on average would probably have a lower reported average in terms of utilization of open source software. And, you know, that indeed is, you know, would line up with our research as well. So it does vary industry to industry. I think that's, you know, even given that variability between different sectors, I think one of the broader points I'm hoping that you can all take away from this slide is the fact that the use of these different sources, whether external or even assets from previous in-house projects, you know, that doesn't necessarily erase project development concerns. So although the use of, you know, of this broader network of software IP sources can, you know, obviously help reduce some of the pressures on the software development resources you might have, it can also create an additional need for more sophisticated lifecycle management solutions. And this could be tools like source change configuration management tools, IP compliance management tools, or automated test tools that you'd need to use in order to help ensure the legitimacy, the quality, and ultimately the functionality of the final software stack and device you'd look to put in the field. And another trend that we've been following closely over recent years, you know, as Mark talked about before, is the usage of multi-core processor configurations within the embedded market. And clearly, this is a topic that has received a significant amount of attention in the industry over recent years. And, you know, largely this has been led to some degree by silicon manufacturers, marketing initiatives, as well as, I think, just the community's general familiarity with multi-core technology as a result of PC and server class systems. But as many of you all know, the embedded market it's really a different animal entirely. And the inherent diversity of the embedded market has led to there being a wide range of processing requirements, you know, within each of those different device classes, you know, many of which have not necessarily needed the additional processing power offered by the newest chipsets available. And in fact, if you go back and look at some of our research, you know, as I have up on this slide from 2008, you can see that we're still lagging engineers' expectations from the time regarding the rate of multi-core processor adoption when in 2008 we went and asked them, you know, what they expected to be using within 2 years. And so beyond just any potential gaps there might be in the broader embedded market organic need for the additional processing power provided by multi-core processors. There are, however, a few important factors that we think contributed initially to what was a slower than expected uptick. I mean, for one, as I'm sure many, if not all of you have heard before, it can be significantly challenging to develop software that can efficiently exploit the full capabilities that are offered by multi-core configurations, especially with most embedded engineers' experience relegated to languages like C that largely have been used to date to support serial program development. And I guess of perhaps even greater consideration to a lot of OEMs just has been the amount of investment that legacy code bases represent. And while it's certainly a challenge to develop software from scratch for these platforms, it can be even more challenging to ensure that legacy software assets are ported correctly and that no previously undetected runtime errors occur. So we expect that this transition has caused OEMs to date to defer transition to multi-core as long as possible given all those considerations. So now if you look at the title of my slide, I say multi-core is finally here, and so you might say, what's so different now? And at one level, I can say not a lot. I mean, the basic challenges are still there. Now, however, many OEMs can no longer afford to defer that movement to multi-core. Silicon roadmaps and their own software requirements are really beginning to force their hand. And so as a result, we're now seeing and anticipate further that both runtime and tool solutions offered by people like Wind River, just as an example, that can be aimed at addressing some of the underlying issues that accompany multi-core software development are going to be placed by a higher premium, at a higher premium by a larger portion of the embedded engineering community going forward. And so as I was just discussing on the previous slide, the engineering community needs to and is continuing to look for new solutions that can offer a means to abstract the complexity brought on by the move to multi-core processors. And one of the solutions that more engineering organizations are turning to is virtualization, which can allow a target device to run multiple operating systems over the same piece of silicon, potentially allowing organizations to more easily run existing software assets over one of their legacy operating system selections that maybe was designed to specifically run with their application over one core. And as you can see from the findings from our 2011 embedded survey, more and more engineers are reporting that they're using virtualization in their current project. And in fact, if you look back at our 2008 results, the current project use rates are up almost 50%. But the potential applications of this technology and use cases is not limited to just solving multi-core related issues. Engineering organizations can look to this type of technology for a number of reasons, which could include the ability to enhance system security, reduce bill of material costs through processor consolidation, or even allow the creation of multiple profiles, so to speak, that can partition enterprise and consumer assets. And whereas the adoption of the technology is expected to increase going forward, but we believe this, our research shows that, I think all the trends in the industry are pointing to that, it is working against a few different factors that are inhibiting its growth. And first of which is just awareness of the technology and its potential use cases. And despite the increasingly commonplace, use of virtualization technology in the enterprise for server use cases, a majority of engineers we surveyed earlier this year we remained less than extremely familiar with the embedded version of the technology. And, in addition, we asked engineers about what they thought or they perceived the benefits of virtualization were, as well as what they thought some of the their concerns about potential use of the technology was. And they said, around the concerns, they talked about potential impacts on latency or potentially adding another software licensing costs. But even all those, potential inhibitors aside, we anticipate the growth and the adoption and really the potential utility of this technology is going to continue to grow going forward as more OEMs look to really facilitate their development to new hardware architectures, one, and additionally support the move and the additional potentially security considerations driving from things like connectivity requirements and the connectivity evolution that Mark was talking about earlier. But again, this is just, you know, multi-core is just one of the potential trends pushing this, but it is one of those solutions we think, you know, more people might look to going forward. And this is another slide here where I wanted to take a moment to highlight some of the various types of tools that are also being used in the embedded market. And as you can see from this list, your more traditional types of software development tools, like compilers, debuggers, editors, et cetera, you know, they remain to be the things that the engineering community obviously is using most when we go out and we survey them. They continue to say that they are using those technologies, as you would anticipate. But even given that current use case, there's still a number of different types of tools that we believe will be coming of increasing use and value to a number of engineering organizations. So as I mentioned before, software content growth is placing a tremendous amount of strain on embedded project teams, and a large percent of projects are being reported as behind schedule. And the growth in complexity, as well as just the general broadening of engineering roles, is causing a lot of organizations to look for tools that can offer higher levels of automation, and that would be both towards aiding engineering execution as well as the management of the engineering projects themselves. Test automation tools are one prime example of where we see the growth in the software content pushing many engineering organizations, you know, to really take another look at what tools they're using. And just the sheer increase in the size of software content has greatly reduced, you know, the efficacy of traditional manual testing, and is causing many organizations to, again, look towards automated methods to try to ensure that their software quality. And even within this broader category of automated test tools, specifically we're seeing more engineers adopt static analysis tools, not only to assess software quality in ways, in different methods and means than some of the traditional tools used, but also as a way to accelerate part of that QA process earlier into the development process. And in general, software, according to our research results, again, is accounting for close to 50% of development costs. And obviously also generating more and more of end users' perception of embedded devices' value. With, again, engineering organizations really now being pushed to find new ways to just accelerate the software development portion of their entire system development process. And one of the other solutions that can help engineering organizations make progress to this goal is virtual platforms. And these solutions, you know, which could include things like Synopsys's Comet Meteor, as well as Wind River Simics platform, can allow engineers to begin software development ahead of the availability of end devices' final hardware. And so tools like these, whether it's virtual platforms or static analysis or requirements management, these are all tools that we believe can help organizations address the challenges of today's embedded device requirements, you know, as they become more complex, as there's more software content being driven towards the end functionality goals. The adoption of these new types of tool technologies, however, it's not a guaranteed cure-all to fix all the maladies within the engineering community. I think it's important to remember and keep the context around that these technologies need to be implemented alongside the processes that are needed to support their specific use cases, and with training to ensure that engineering teams can, you know, minimize ramp-up time and ultimately maximize value from the new solutions and processes they look to implement. And so with that, I'm going to, you know, I appreciate the time to talk about some different trends we're seeing in our research. I'm going to pass the mic back over to Mark Brown.
Thank you, Chris. So with that data, I'm going to walk through and really go through some of the technologies, education services, and mentoring or guidance areas that we believe are going to be crucial for organizations to deal with this increased complexity. Now, what we really wanted to do by looking at how organizations basically define, develop, and deploy their devices is to take a very process-agnostic view of the traditional steps that an engineering team will go through to basically create the next generation device within their particular markets. So we came up with a high-level framework that really tries to isolate the key activities in each of the various stages that are required to create a device. And if we just go around these very quickly, and then I'll drop into each of these and go through a little bit more in detail and talk about some of the critical components. You know, initially we've defined a definition or a defined stage. This is where people are putting their requirements together. Most likely they're going to be doing some prototyping, doing some analysis to ensure that the requirements that they're actually going to seal for the system, both functional and non-functional requirements, really represent the device, the performance characteristics, the power use, as well as the other aspects that the device has to support. Secondarily, you know, as hardware becomes available, there's always a bring-up stage. And you could think of this traditionally for bringing up the hardware and the hardware components, but you could also think of this as bringing up the runtime platform that you need to be available for your teams to use to allow them to develop their IP and applications on. The third area here is around the overall device application development, really focusing on the IP that your organizations are going to differentiate your devices with. There's certainly the integration stage, and this is where we're bringing all of the various components together, and we're going to be using a number of testing capabilities and code analytics capabilities to verify that what you're bringing together meets the requirements that were defined up front. And again, this is very process agnostic. You know, people could be using an agile method like Scrum. They could be using, you know, a waterfall process. They could be using an iterative process. It's very, very flexible. And again, many of these activities will be done in many different cycles or iterations throughout the life, the development life cycle of the product. And then lastly, we call out the sustaining components. Once you've deployed the device, you do need to be able to sustain that device. You need to provide updates to it. You need to provide patches and all the other things that you're going to need, maybe even enhance the device as the device is in service. Many of the embedded devices that, you know, certainly Wind River is involved with are in service for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years or more. So, you know, having a good sustaining aspect is very crucial as well. Now, the crucial thing that I'm going to do is I want to start really with the services and education piece. Chris actually touched on that at the end of his conversation, and I think it's a very critical component. Many of these areas are never going to be solved by tools alone. Tools are going to provide your teams the necessary productivity gains and insights that they couldn't do manually. Certainly, if you want to be competitive, you're going to need tools and each of these areas to help support the various activities. But first and foremost, you need to think about your development process, the best practices that you're going to be following, best practices that your teams may want to adopt to deal with, you know, new security concerns or new issues around global connectivity. So when we look backwards at my earlier comments about some of the key market drivers, your team should be thinking about how are we going to continually and continuously involve our development process to deal with these new complexities that are coming into your organization that are being driven by the marketplace. Wind River has got, you know, a number of key education services and professional services capabilities that can help organizations understand, you know, best practices. You know, an example, you know, good security practices when using a Wind River platform, whether it's Linux or VxWorks or something else. And it could be also looking at quality practices, things that you should be thinking about to improve your overall quality, and at the same time, continuing to improve your overall efficiencies and productivity. So that's a very critical component that you know, your teams need to think about. Now, if we look at the defined phase, as I mentioned, this is where you document, analyze, and really explore the system architecture, system requirements that you're going to capture to basically spec out what your device is going to be when it's deployed and in service. There are some very critical components here. I mean, one of the things that organizations are looking at today, given the new complexities of system consolidation and multiple operating environments and virtualization, is doing more prototyping up front. And Chris mentioned virtual platforms. This is a very good way to use Wind River's Simix offer, where you can actually simulate an environment. You could actually simulate your next-generation device and do a number of what-if scenarios as you're defining your overall requirements to try to get your requirements nailed as accurate as possible up front before you move into, you know, a more traditional software development phase. You could also explore some of the hardware characteristics and some of the hardware platform differences. So one of the exciting things with the Simix product is you could also do trade-offs between, you know, what's my device potentially going to act like if I use a power architecture versus an Intel architecture versus an ARM architecture. There are models for each of those, and you could look at each of those and try to do trade-offs right up front to help you with your silicon optimizations or silicon decisions, as well as all of the functional, non-functional software requirements that your system's going to have to deal with. So there's a tremendous number of benefits by using a virtual platform like Simix, and it could be looking at something as low level as a driver to architecture, all the way up to the full system itself, and looking at all of those various dimensions throughout. You might even want to, you know, evaluate some middleware that you're going to buy from a third party and run it on that virtual platform to look at its potential benefits. So there's a lot of really good things you can do up front to do more of your what-if analysis to get your definition sound and solid before you move on to the actual software development areas. Now, the next area is bring up, and this is a very challenging area. This is an area that people traditionally think that it's really around the hardware. But for us, especially with the, you know, more and more adoption of COTS hardware, it's really about bringing up not only the hardware platform, but the basic runtime platform. And the basic runtime platform may, you know, constitute of an operating system, maybe some middleware like a, you know, a network or file system or some other types of middleware that you're going to be running on that base software platform. One of the things that we can do at Wind River is to certainly help you on both sides. We've got Wind River Workbench on-chip debugging to help bring up the hardware itself and get it to where the operating system is going to boot. It can also help flush out some of the device drivers and some of the software areas that you may be developing yourselves if you've got some custom hardware. But I think the really exciting thing here is looking at, you know, technologies and tools beyond on-chip debugging, which is a traditional kind of a well-understood area. One of the things that we've recently made available is a number of test suites that are packaged with our Wind River Test Management offer to allow you to validate the conformance of the operating environment that you've basically deployed in your area. So whether you're deploying VxWorks or Wind River Linux, you can use the test management product to verify that if you've made tweaks or augmentations to the operating platform, that it still is conformant with what was delivered. You haven't inserted any potential issues or defects that are going to impact your applications. So it's a great way to get your entire hardware and software platform up and stable while your development teams, who may be, you know, in parallel working on applications but on the virtual Simix offer, get that up, you know, the software and hardware platform up as stable as possible, so that when the application development starts on the actual environment, they can, you know, they've got confidence that it's, you know, all sorted out and really ready for them to go, fully optimized and so on. Now, the next area is around development. Again, this is an area that, you know, we've for many, many years have been providing a very comprehensive set of development tools that really support all the traditional edit, build, debug activities. But above and beyond that, we've certainly continued to invest and
provide additional capabilities to give you more insights on what's going on in the system, really bolstering the monitoring and the analytics activities as well. So this is an area that you can use Workbench to really try to gain all of those insights of what's going on in your code, your applications as you develop it. You can also leverage other technologies here, right? You could be using Simics if you don't have enough hardware platforms for your applications team to use. You could have a virtual systems environment that they could develop their apps directly on. And again, one of the really nice benefits of developing in a virtual environment is it gives you some very unique ways to debug. Simics would allow developers to not only capture a system issue, but to actually step backwards in the entire system, which is sometimes very, very challenging to do on actual hardware, where a defect may only show up in a random basis. And if you're trying to figure out what that random defect is, you could wait a day, a week. Sometimes you could wait months before that defect shows up again. But in a virtual environment, if the defect appears, you can basically step backwards and really try to find the root of the cause very, very quickly. And I know internally we use the technology. We found internally that our development processes are on the order of 20 to 30 times more quick or quicker by using this simulation technology versus actual hardware. Now, if you move on to the integration stage, this is a very, very critical stage of the development where you're bringing various components together. You might bring two components together. You may be bringing the entire system together. And this is, again, another key area that Wind River Test Management is there to help basically measure your overall test coverage. This is a very critical component that when you're going through and trying to determine how much of my system have I really tested, you need to gain those insights, because if you've got code that's dead code that's and hasn't been tested, you want to make sure that you're confident that you've got your requirements basically traced and mapped back to your test cases, and you can verify that the functional behavior that you're expecting has been tested. And as things evolve through the various iterations, if you're using an iterative or an agile process, you've got the test suites there that you can continue to run in a very quick fashion, giving you insights immediately if there's something that goes wrong. With the addition of many more multi-OS systems, this is becoming much more critical. Now, in addition to that, test management provides the ability also to help you manage your hardware assets, which is a very, very crucial thing. It's sometimes challenging when you've got a minimum number of hardware boards that people want to test against. Test management has some really exciting features to help you basically develop your test cases, map them to certain types of environments, hardware environments, and make sure that those tests are run in an automated fashion. And then you're provided the visibility on potential issues, whether it's failed test cases or areas that you don't have adequate coverage. Now, there's certainly a lot of other things you can do and look here when you're bringing the system together. You should also be looking at the overall performance of the system. You may have tests that are developed specifically to stress the system in certain ways that you can verify that you've got adequate performance metrics. You may also want to look at it and look at certain things at the hardware level by using an on-chip debugger as well. Now, the last item here is the sustain phase, and again, this is very, very crucial. Many of the embedded devices that are developed are in service for multiple years. Unlike the consumer space where, your devices do transition quite early, if we look at the industrial, the energy and transportation, the network infrastructure, the aerospace defense, most of those systems that are deployed are going to be in service for a long period of time. And this is another critical area that you're going to need the tools in place to help you get those systems upgraded, make sure that if there's a defect that you can replicate those things. And there's a number of critical things that you can do here. One of the unique things that a virtual platform can provide is it can provide your support organization or your customer support or organization the ability to have virtual systems at their desk. So if a defect comes in, they can try to replicate it right there on the spot. without having the need for a lot of very, very costly hardware. And there's a number of other things that certainly we'd want to spend some time on the post-deployment side. But again, we just don't have the cycles today. So with that, Chris, I'm going to turn it back to you and let you wrap up just a little bit more on BDC, and then we'll turn it over to Q&A.
Great. Thanks, Mark. So the last bit that, or slide that I wanted to talk to here really was just, again, to give a little more background on BDC and some of our research. You know, largely within the presentation itself that when I was talking before, I was discussing some of our demand-side research. So I mentioned we reach out to the engineering community multiple times a year, but for the context of this presentation, I was discussing the results from one of our main annual surveys. And that's just one side of the research and way we look at the market. We also look at a number of other technology markets in particular. And so looking at things like embedded real-time operating systems, Android, virtualization is another one, as well as different security solutions. These are all different technologies that we look at, not only for in terms of some of the trends as driven by the engineering community itself, but also looking at the evolution of the commercial market and the different trends impacting that. So in 2012, up on that first list of topics, those are all different areas we're going to be conducting full reports on, looking at both the supply side market opportunity as well as some of the other trends impacting that solution. And within those reports, we look at the competitive landscape and, for example, in the operating system report, talking about Wind River and some of its competitors and some of the things that are really impacting and driving some of the things that Wind River is doing and how we see some of their announcements impacting the market as a whole going forward. And then those next series of reports that are classified there as embedded system engineering survey data, that's where we take different segmentations and views and connect analysis of some of our flagship demand-side research and really try to dive into some of the trends we see based upon different communities of interest. So during the discussion about CIMIX, Mark was talking about how you'd be able to, more or less toggle back and forth between different, ARM or x86-based processor designs to see potential impacts on the software development as an example. Well, we also try to look at that and provide engineering organizations a way to evaluate some of the trends and characteristics that might result from the alignment to one of those architectures or how projects in general might compare industry to industry or, what are the different characteristics related to the ecosystem around different types of operating systems, whether that's open source, commercial, or Linux-based, et cetera. So we try to provide a number of different ways people can try to ascertain different understandings of the market and different trends within them. And then finally, we're also going to be conducting a series of reports. We're going to dive in deep into some of the trends impacting some of the different vertical markets that we track as leading sectors within the embedded industry, being automotive, rail and transportation, industrial automation, medical devices, military aerospace, and mobile phones. And within each one of those reports, not only are we going to be looking at some of the leading trends that are driving decision-making in some of those engineering organizations in terms of what some of those engineers are saying in terms of their preferences, expectations, and past experiences, but we're also going to be looking at how some of the different leading application classes within those industries are evolving and what different types of unit shipments and you can currently see and expect going forward in terms of what types of growth we're expecting in each one of those industries. So those are just a few of the different things that research topics we'll be covering as part of 2012. In addition to some other topics, there's a number of other lifecycle management tools and solutions that we cover as part of an adjacent and parallel research program, as well as the fact we conduct any number of different custom research topics looking at the embedded market over the course of the year. So if any of you all have any questions about our research program or our market research capabilities in general, please feel free to reach out to me given the contact information on the slide here. And so with that, I guess we can turn it over to Q&A.
Very good. Thanks, Mark. Chris, we'll go to the Q&A now. Let's see here. We've got a number of good questions. Please also continue to ask them. How about first one from Mark? You mentioned Simix quite a bit. Can you elaborate on, is this a project management tool, an emulator simulator? Is it an environment?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, Simix is a virtual platform that can be used to simulate a number of different software or hardware capabilities. It's a simulation environment that can emulate an entire system. So, you know, you may have a system that's controlling, let's say, you know, some transportation actuators on a rail system that you want to simulate the device. You can do that at the system level. You could simulate a network switch. But as I mentioned earlier, you could also use it to simulate other lower-level components. You may want it to simulate a processor. You may want it to, you know, use it to simulate maybe a processor and some of the I/O components that you're looking at. So it's a very unique technology that allows organizations to simulate at a macro level or a micro level, depending on really what their needs are. But if you know, if your goal is to simulate a system, you can do that. If your goal is to simulate a processor, you can do that as well. In fact, many of the semis are actually using this technology. Intel and Freescale and others use this technology to actually simulate their processors and some of their I/O devices.
I see. Okay. Chris, you spoke about the issues revolving around security and virtualization as possible solutions. What if you don't want to use virtualization in your embedded development? Is there anything else that you can do there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's just one of the few potential ways people try to improve the security of their end devices. And, you know, again, I also want to emphasize there's not necessarily one fix to security. I mean, people can make different choices in terms of the operating system they use. I mentioned virtualization, but it can also influence what types of tools people want to use. So that could be using things like static analysis tools to identify potential defects in code that would maybe provide a, you know, a waypoint for intrusion ultimately for some type of connected device. Organizations could, you know, they could also look to things like coding standards just to help implement best practices for coding. And then, you know, there's all, depending upon the device class, there's also the possibility for organizations to look towards different, you know, other types of runtime solutions. You know, and whether that's something like from a McAfee or something along that nature, they can act as a, you know, an additional barrier to, or at least monitoring, if not prevention of some of those intrusion threats around security.
Okay, very good. Speaking of virtualization, there is a question asking us to elaborate on what virtualization runtime software is. Is it actually embedded or offline or for modeling? You know, I guess we typically use virtualization in the case of abstracting a multi-core, multi-processor system into what looks to the software as one unified environment. Mark, maybe you can elaborate on that a bit.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's two components, and let me make sure I cover the question accurately. One is you can use virtualization within your embedded device, and it's basically using a hypervisor, much like the enterprise market's done today, where many enterprises today, they deploy VMware on a server, and they have one physical device, but on that physical device, they could have 10, 20 virtual devices running. So you could have, you know, in a sense, one server, but on the server, it would look like 10 or 20 servers all running their own independent operating system and their own independent applications, sharing all of the, you know, the hardware of the server, so you can get more utilization of your capital costs.
Right.
The embedded space, people are doing similar things, although in the embedded space, most of the time we're not actually trying to share devices. We're actually using virtualization for system isolation and system separation, where through, you know, let's say a system consolidation play where you've got a network, a device today that's got six or seven line cards, you basically collapse all those into one processor, but logically you still have them separated on the processor through virtualization.
Right.
So that's really what we're talking about here. And Wind River has its own hypervisor. It was developed, you know, to be a type one hypervisor, very small footprint, high performance, supports our runtimes both natively and paravirtualized, as well as other operating systems such as Windows and Linux and so forth.
Right. Okay. Very good. Here's a question that's basically for both of you. I think, Chris, maybe you can start, and Mark, you can chime in. Do you have any research or, as far as Wind River is concerned, experience on incorporating more third-party code and how it affects the test and development validation phase of the project? Does that impact the development schedules? Is there any research or experience you have there, for better or worse?
Well, so just to tackle that first, outside of the context specific to, you know, Wind River talking, looking more broadly at the embedded market, you know, I don't know if there's I don't think I have any specific research talking about, you know, to qualify something's better or worse. I mean, because it's just in general, it's hard to compare any one project to another. There's a lot of moving parts, as you all know, in bringing an embedded device to market. That said, it's one more, you're introducing one or potentially many more factors into considerations for, you know, trying to ensure not only functionality implementation of, you know, as you integrate these discrete parts, you don't necessarily always have visibility into the origin of some of these components. So even beyond functionality, there can be issues around IP infringement potentially.
Right.
You know, in addition to just the need to manage these assets in parallel to internal assets in terms of managing change. You know, especially when you talk about the, you know, increasing use of more iterative development methodologies and embedded, where, you know, obviously when you look at enterprise IT software development, it's a little bit more linear, or not linear, but it's not as layered of a process. You know, in the embedded market, as I mentioned before, you're trying to coordinate, you know, multiple different streams of development around different engineering tasks.
Right.
And that just has another layer of complexity to that whole process.
Right. Okay. Mark, in terms of your experience with Wind River, does third-party code mean shorter development cycles, more better-tested code?
You know, I think in the end, much like Chris said, it really depends on the third-party code. You know, what was interesting as Chris was providing his own insights here is if you just think about the embedded Linux environment, there's many, many packages available today for people to leverage and use. Not everyone uses all of Linux. And again, you know, depending on where the package came from, its origins, it may have better quality, it may have poor quality. I think in the end, you know, anybody that's wanting to layer in third-party code, they've got to have confidence that, one, that they're looking at commercial-grade code, and that's gonna be a big boost and starter for them.
Right.
And two, you just got to know where the origins are from. And if you've got a partner that's got test suites for their code, it even makes it easier because then you could layer those tests directly into our test management facility and automate those tests as you continue developing and using that third-party code.
Okay, very good. Thank you very much. We're running out of time here, so I'm going to try to lump a few of these questions in that are kind of a common theme. There were bullet points that said workbench on-chip debugging, Simics. Are these separate plugins? Is this one unified environment that we're talking about? Is it analogous to an Eclipse-type environment? And then there were some specific questions about Simics and comparing it to Simulink LabVIEW, as well as, you know, compilers like DEB compilers versus GCC. How does all this fit within the Wind River Workbench environment?
Yeah, so Workbench is a suite of products. Workbench itself is very similar to an Eclipse CDT.
Mm-hmm.
But what we've done is it's a commercial grade product. It's been extended in a Eclipse-like fashion to provide additional value that customers need who are developing in the embedded space, in particular on Wind River Linux or VxWorks or our other runtime platforms. The OCD product is really just an extension of Workbench that allows you to connect to a JTAG interface and, you know, connect and debug through the JTAG interface versus using a software agent that, you know, most software people in the enterprise space, or even a lot of cross-development people will use a software agent. So if you want to connect up directly to the hardware and use this JTAG interface, OCD allows you to do that and debug at that level, at the systems level.
Okay.
Now, as far as the other questions, I mean, DAV is it's a really well-known compiler. It was built in a proprietary fashion. It's highly optimized for many architectures. It differs a bit from GCC in the fact that it's a proprietary compiler. It could be certified. It can do a lot of things and be used in environments where it may be challenging to do with GCC, just because GCC is such a large compiler.
Right.
But again, I think that's enough for right now.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of our time limit for the Q&A. Really appreciate the audience for attending and asking those good questions. And again, thank you very much to Mark Brown and Chris Rommel for taking the time to be with us and share some really important insights in embedded development. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen, and an audio-only podcast will also be made available. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of the Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. Also invite you to participate in the Multicore Tech Channel, where we follow Wind River among with all others multi-core technology movers and shakers. Simply follow multicore_tech on Twitter or join that LinkedIn group as well. Thank you all for attending, and have a great day.